In this hour of our show, we will revisit a topic that we have discussed before, and I expect we'll continue to discuss. We're trying to do that from a variety of perspectives, and the topic is genetically engineered food. And our guest this morning for this show is Peter Rossett. He's co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. It is a think tank and education center interested in the idea that food is a human right. They're also interested in reshaping the global food system to make it socially just and also environmentally sustainable. In his academic background, he's an agroecologist and rural development specialist. He holds a PhD from University of Michigan. He has published a number of books, including the book World Hunger, 12 Myths, which we have discussed on this show. Also other sorts of things. He's also written widely on hunger, on biotechnology and agriculture, on sustainable agriculture. He's published in academic journals as well as other publications, including the New York Times, International Herald Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, and others. And we're talking this morning about some of the arguments that have been made by his group and others against genetically engineered food. Questions, of course, are welcome, whether you agree or disagree. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you'd like to call in, all we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and try and keep our conversation moving along. But anyone's welcome, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Well, Dr. Rossett, hello.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we're sure glad to have you on the program. You've been on our show before, have you not?
I think I've been on a couple of times before and greatly enjoyed it.
Well, maybe the place that we can start in on this topic is to talk about the Starlink story. That's the thing that has certainly got a lot of people's attention. And as people will recall, what happened was this is the long and the short of it, and you can give more detail, but a particular kind of genetically engineered corn, which was not approved for human consumption, showed up in some taco shells, and then it was found to be in some other products as well, which raised a number of important questions. Maybe the big question was, if we tell ourselves that we can segregate GM crops, and if we say that something like this, we don't want it to get into the food system, so people are eating it directly, can we really do that? How easy is it going to be if we are going to have these soybeans and corn and other things that are genetically engineered? If we decide we want to keep them separate, can we really do it?
That's right. We wrote a report about this called Anatomy of a Gene Spill, because we think that the analogy is quite interesting between an oil spill and a gene spill. Obviously, both have environmental consequences. One significant difference, though, is if a tanker ruptures and oil is spilled onto the ocean, there's the possibility of throwing a boom around the spill and containing how far it goes. However, if you plant genetically modified crops in the environment, it's very different, because crops pollinate both other varieties of the same crop, say other corn varieties planted elsewhere, or closely related wild plants can hybridize with them, so that the pollen containing the modified genetic material can begin to move through natural populations, through the ecosystem, and there's no way that you can put a boom around genes once we've spilled them into the environment. So we think that there's a real difference, and if we're going to be seriously take into account the health and environmental consequences of these kinds of spills, we need to think about the difficulty of containing them once they occur. And obviously that would put a lot of burden on pre-testing before anything is released. Unfortunately, that's not really being done. And so this really highlights that issue.
Mm-hmm. And certainly here, you know, we have seen problems with farmers planting crops that they thought were clean as far as the GM content goes, and then taking them down to the grain elevator and having them look at them and come back to the farmer and says, look, you got some GM here, and if it exceeds a certain level, then it doesn't mean that the farmer can't sell it, but it means that they may get less for that crop than they had anticipated.
That's right. It's terrible. It started first for organic farmers, because if you want to export certified organic to Europe, they test your product to make sure it's GE-free, genetically engineered free. And organic farmers were finding problems where they would detect genetically modified material in their crops because of cross-pollination from neighbors' fields. That was the first step. The second step now is farmers who are just trying to sell regular corn, not even certified organic, but because this particular genetic material is not approved for human consumption, basically all the grain elevators now are testing for the presence of it, and farmer after farmer after farmer who are planting a completely different variety are coming up with these positive tests, which of course are negative for the farmer, because then instead of getting the high price they would get for corn for human consumption, they get the very low price that farmers get for corn for animal feed. And there are quite a few lawsuits now springing up from different farmers and farmers groups trying to seek placing the responsibility for this onto the companies that release these organisms. Of course, there is no legal framework in place that says where liability lies, and so it's kind of a case-by-case situation where the courts will have to decide.
Why has Starlink not been approved for human consumption?
Well, it's quite interesting, because the larger picture is that our regulatory agencies, whether we're talking about the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, the Food and Drug Administration, which is the FDA, or the Department of Agriculture, which is the USDA, they have largely been asleep at the wheel, and they have largely not lifted a finger to require any mandatory testing. The only exception where they've momentarily woken up is in the case of very likely food allergens. And their definition of a potential food allergen is any novel protein that is not destroyed by the digestive juices and therefore passes in a hole through the system. And that means it could become a food allergen. Therefore, the only variety of genetically engineered corn that has not been approved for human consumption was the particular one that has now shown up all over the place. And it's because it contains a gene which codes for an insecticide, which is produced inside the crop itself, inside the corn. It's called the Cry9 protein, which is an insecticidal protein, and it turns out is not broken down by the human digestive process. Therefore, it's a likely food allergen. So despite the fact that the regulatory agencies have been asleep, they did actually prohibit one particular variety. And ironic as it is, that's the variety now that's turned up everywhere where it shouldn't be.
Bacillus thuringiensis, this insecticide that the plants have been engineered to produce so that the plants essentially will protect themselves against insects. That is, the insects will eat the plant, then they'll ingest the insecticide and they'll die.
Exactly.
The thing about a lot of people like about BT is that they think that it's a more natural substance, and a lot of gardeners use this. And also the thing about BT that's apparently good is that it's fairly narrowly tailored. If you have a particular pest that you want to get rid of, you got to make sure that you have the right kind of BT to work on it. So having said all that, is there really good evidence to show that Bacillus thuringiensis, particularly this kind, would be at all harmful to humans?
Well, this is a very interesting question. As you said, there is another form of Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT as it's called. This is a bacteria, Bacillus thuringiensis, a naturally occurring soil bacteria which produces a natural toxin, which is an insecticide for certain insects, but very luckily is not toxic to mammals. And so organic farmers will apply a formulation containing either the bacteria itself or the toxin that the natural bacteria produces to kill pests on their fields without any fear that this would be toxic for people. So the idea, I guess, that the biotechnology companies had was to take the gene from the bacteria that makes the bacteria produce this toxin and put it into the plant and have the plant produce a supposedly non-toxic insecticide. There is a problem, and this is a problem that they're very reluctant to talk about. If you actually examine the molecule that's produced by the same gene when it's in the plant and compare it to the molecule that that gene produces when it's in a bacteria, it's a very different molecule. It's only two-thirds the size of the one produced by the bacteria. And the first and only time that people have tested to see if it's as selective as the bacteria one, meaning that it would only kill a narrow range of organisms and not others, therefore be non-toxic for others, the Swiss Federal Institute in Switzerland did a test and found out that it had a completely different range of toxicities. They did not test it for people or for mammals, but whereas the bacteria-produced insecticide will only kill one or two kinds of insects, it turns out that the one produced by the plant will kill all the insects they tested it on. Very alarming. As I said, no one tested to see if this would affect human beings, because our wonderful regulatory agencies decided that since the bacterial version was already tested, that the version produced by plants wouldn't have to be tested. So basically, we're guinea pigs for a wide range of crops containing BT proteins, because many other varieties of BT corn or BT tomatoes and other crops containing the BT gene are approved and are in our food supply. This particular variant, the Cry9 variant of BT, is the only one that was not approved. But there's reason to be concerned about all of them.
Yeah, I think that this gets at a point where that shows just how perhaps difficult it is to talk about this, or how people can be confused, because it seems as if people who are arguing in favor of the technology are saying, at this point, we have no evidence to show that these genetically modified foods pose any risk to human health. And that it seems that that's true, yet at the same time, various groups like yours and other environmentalists would have to say, yes, that's true. At the same time, we would also have to say we have no evidence to show that it's not harmful. The fact is that one way or another, we have no evidence. We simply don't know.
Because the policy of our regulatory agencies can be summed up as don't look, don't find. Essentially, they have not been doing the studies, and they have not been mandating that others do the studies. And so we're basically operating in a vacuum. The organizations and movements that express a concern, are basing our concern on what I would call preliminary and suggestive evidence. It's not conclusive evidence. I would be lying if I said that I know that these products are bad for you, or I know these products will cause X damage to the environment. I don't know. And I don't say that I know. I say that I'm concerned that they might. Now, when industry and their supporters say there's no evidence that they're safe, that they're dangerous,
right.
As you say, they are manipulating the truth, in the sense that because the studies haven't been done, there's no evidence. But that doesn't mean that once the studies were actually done, were they to be done, there would still be no evidence.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Peter Rossett. He's co-director of Food First. It is both a think tank and an educational organization that's interested in food issues, particularly issue of sustainability, but also other sorts of issues, including whether or not people around the world have access to food, and also various sorts of environmental issues. It's a rather broad range of things that they're interested in, have many publications. They have a website, by the way, if you're interested in finding out more about them, at www.foodfirst.org. So if you have access to the web, you can go there and find out about them and some of their publications. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Urbana to talk with, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in the mechanics of the gene transfer. A while back, in the past, I've heard that there's evidence of gene transfer in the wild, not simply between related or even unrelated species, but different genera, where viruses pick up a gene and then apparently transfer it to another plant. Is there evidence for this?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And this is a whole area that is basically being glossed over, especially by supporters of the technology, unless they want to use it essentially to mislead us. There is, in nature, there are viruses and other very small microbial organisms that do remove pieces of DNA from one organism and move them into another. This is a fairly common occurrence. However, most organisms, whether they're plants or human beings or other animals, have natural protection against that. If you look at the particular genes, for example, on our chromosome, they don't work very well by themselves. They have a variety of other genes that are called regulatory genes or regulator genes that manipulate their behavior, that, for example, make sure that they don't go wild and produce too much of a substance or that they don't turn off when they're not supposed to turn off. So these regulator genes and other genes called modifier genes operate on the genes that we already have. These same regulator and modifier genes make sure that any foreign DNA that's inserted into our chromosome is essentially turned off. Because this happens all the time by viruses moving small bits of DNA into us, we need to have this fail-safe mechanism that will turn off any gene that comes in without its modifiers or its regulators. So there's a built-in protection that nature has given us and all other organisms and plants against this kind of natural gene transfer. The difference when they do the transfer in genetic engineering, they have this problem. If they just put in the DNA by itself, the gene, it won't function because it doesn't have the modifiers or the regulators. So what they discovered is something called a promoter gene. It comes from a virus called the cauliflower mosaic virus, and if you put that gene in with another gene, it magnifies the response of the gene you're putting in by several hundred or thousand fold, and it basically allows the new gene to break any self-defense mechanism that normally would not allow new genetic material to function. They create what's called a cassette, and it's several genes together, the gene of interest plus this promoter gene and plus other genes that make it easier for this genetic material to be taken out of one chromosome and put into another. So when they insert a gene, they break the natural defense so that the new gene will actually function or express itself.
Having done this, what is to prevent the virus from transferring?
Say that again?
Having done this, what is to prevent a virus from transferring both the promoter gene and some other gene?
Precisely. That's the concern that industry is glossing over. Not only do they have the promoter gene with this new gene, but they also have what's called a recombination hotspot gene, which means that it breaks off more easily and can more easily be picked up by a virus. This is one of the largest risks that is least discussed. These genes that they're inserting are many orders of magnitude more likely to be taken, picked up by a virus because of the recombination hotspots, inserted into another organism, maybe not even another plant, maybe an animal, maybe you in your stomach, with the promoter gene that will break all of your self-defense mechanisms against this gene, this foreign gene expressing itself. So it's actually highly dangerous. And this particular kind of risk, which is called horizontal transfer, vertical transfer is from parent to child, horizontal transfer is by viruses from organism to organism. This may be an enormous risk, but it's a potential risk because nobody's studying it.
May I ask another, say something? A while back, David had another guest who was in favor of genetic modification. He absolutely denied that this was the agency for transferring genes, although I've done enough reading that I knew the virus was used quite often with animals.
Well, sometimes they use viruses. Sometimes they use a gene gun where they basically shoot it in by physical mechanical force. But they're still shooting it in with the promoter and with the recombination hotspot. So even if they didn't actually use the virus to insert it, it still could be taken out and moved around by a virus in nature.
Well, his assertion was you couldn't do it with a virus, and it was never done with a virus, and I was very skeptical about how much he knew or how truthful he was.
Well, when you get down to that level of biology, the distinction between a virus and a phage and various other very small organisms, some which are merely a little piece of RNA, is not entirely clear to a layman or even to myself who has a PhD in a different area of biology. So it may be technically correct to say that this is not a virus, but in terms of a layman's understanding, it's the closest thing to a virus in terms of something that we would understand what it is. So it's like a virus, let's put it that way.
Well, you've made it much clearer to me. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We have next someone on a cell phone, so we'll talk with them on line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm a local farmer, and I've had a concern that using BT corn may put a more concentrated and maybe persistent BT organism in my soil and potentially be detrimental to soil organisms. Could you speak to that?
Yes. Once again, this is a potential risk that is very little studied. However, some preliminary work was done by some independent scientists under contract to the EPA, and they found that if you plow under the corn stubble after the harvest of BT corn stalks, that the BT that's produced by and exuded by those plants will remain biologically active in the soil for up to 240 days and maybe a lot longer, because they stopped the study after 240 days. Now, this is quite important because as a farmer, you will know that the fertility of your soil has a lot to do with the life in the soil, the various kinds of small insects like Calendula that break down organic matter and recycle it, and the microbes then that play a role in the fungi. So when you're releasing an insecticide over hundreds of days into that soil ecosystem, it's very likely that that ecosystem will be dramatically changed. That, for example, some of the very small insects like Calendula that are key in soil fertility maintenance may be killed. We only know, because the only study that was done, we only know that this insecticide will persist a long time in the soil. We do not know the impact on soil fertility. We can speculate that the impact will be very negative, but once again, this is an area that has not been studied, should be studied, and it's a major risk from the farmer's point of view.
Well, thank you.
All right, and again, to line number three, this is Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I was just wondering two things. One is... if you had any comments about the news that came out this month about a discovery in Australia where they were working with a mouse virus, which is very much like smallpox, which is, you know, as you know, being held in biological warfare banks in both the United States and Russia. And they were working with a mouse virus, and they tried to get the mouse virus to produce interleukin-4. And when they did, they stumbled on a method of making this particular mouse virus lethal, and it killed all the mice. And the immediate thought was that if they took smallpox and did the same thing, it could be a really potent biological warfare. And this was totally unexpected, and it was totally just stumbled on. If you'd heard about that.
I've not heard of that particular case. However, it's very suggestive of another kind of risk that's associated with these crops. One kind of genetically modified crop that will be coming onto the market, in fact has in some cases already, are virus-resistant crops. And what these crops have genetically engineered into them is an actual piece of the coat protein of the viruses themselves. This coat protein now, instead of being produced by the virus, this piece of it is now produced by the plant. And well, it turns out on a virus, the coat protein is what determines what organisms it can attack and how virulent it is when it attacks them. Well, preliminary research, and once again this is in the potential risk area, shows that when the natural virus attacks the plant that has part of the coat protein in it, it can actually take up part of that coat protein and mix it together with the coat protein that it already has and create a completely new molecular configuration, conferring upon that virus a new range of hosts that it can attack and a new degree of virulence on them, in effect creating a completely new virus with unknown hosts that it can attack, unknown to human beings, and unknown effects on them once it attacks them. So similar to them in your case, which I'm not familiar with, but accidentally almost creating a new virus with a new kind of effect, this could happen all the time in nature once they start releasing these virus-resistant crops with the viral coat protein in them into normal ecosystems and planting them in fields. Once again, I can't tell you that this would happen a lot or what the magnitude of the risk is, but it's certainly something I think they should be studying, and they aren't.
Yeah, and isn't that really the key? When you draw to an inside straight in poker, you can figure out what all the different possibilities of your draw might be. But the thing that they keep, denying is that there's so much uncertainty about what'll happen. I mean, there's so much unknown about this entire area that you know, it's really just a crapshoot.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. They would like us to believe that this is a new step, a new scientific step towards greater precision, and they use the word engineering, like as though an engineer knows precisely where the bolt is supposed to be put on the bridge so that the bridge doesn't fall down. In fact, what the caller said is much closer to the truth, that the unknown is far greater than in any aspect of human scientific endeavor really ever before in human history. We're playing with new things that have never happened before, that couldn't happen in nature, and where we really don't know the outcome. And that's why many, 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 many organizations around the world are calling for a moratorium on the commercial use, the planting in commercial fields of these crops, until these risks have been seriously studied with a serious proportion of the research funds, because right now less than 1% of the research funds are being devoted towards analyzing any of the risks, while meanwhile the products are being rushed to market.
Yeah, thanks for having the courage of speaking out like
My
that.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. Well, again, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Dr. Peter Rossett, co-director of Food First. It's a think tank and education center. They're interested in the global food system, making it more just and environmentally sustainable. He is a food rights activist, an agroecologist, and a rural development specialist, and has done a lot of writing, has written a number of books dealing with these various subjects, and also his pieces have appeared in places like the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Seattle Post-Intelligence, or other newspapers. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you're listening to us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. We've been talking about the fact that the question of the impact on human health of GM crops is not been settled. And I'm curious as to why it is that, because there are organizations like yours and that there are others around the world have raised these issues, why isn't anybody doing this work? I would think that for those people who would want to make the argument against GM crops, it would strengthen your argument if you could produce some studies that would say, we believe that it's not good, and here's a study that's been conducted that shows that it's not good. Why aren't those studies being done?
Well, I think the answer to that question comes down to money. Molecular biology is the most expensive field of scientific endeavor. To even begin to do serious molecular biological research, you need to have a research facility that costs millions and millions of dollars to construct, and you need to have research funds to the tune of several million dollars a year, and you need to have a laboratory with 10 or 15 PhD molecular biologists. Now, the only money really that's available for that comes largely from the private sector, from private industry, and you'll see that they're taking over our universities through various kinds of research alliances, or from the government. And so we would hope that our tax dollars, those tax dollars that were being spent on genetic engineering research, would be spent in the public interest, i.e. evaluating the risks. Unfortunately, that's not the case, because of the public funds being spent in the United States by the U.S. government, 99% is being spent to develop new products that can be marketed by industry, and less than 1% of our public money that's being spent in this area is being spent on risk evaluation. So let's say I had a PhD in molecular biology, which I don't. I do have a PhD in biology, but not this area in biology. In order for me to seriously evaluate one of these particular risks, we'd be talking about $10 to $20 million just to get started. And unfortunately, that kind of money isn't available if the private sector and the government aren't willing to pony up, and that's where we're kind of stuck. So we have to rely on some of their accidental results that have leaked out, because they don't generally publish the negative ones, in order to say that there's suggestive evidence. But what we really want is for the government to do its job and to say, stop, do not market these until we seriously evaluate the risks, and let's spend most of the public funds on doing that risk evaluation, and let's force the companies who want to market this stuff to pony up some money for that kind of risk evaluation as well.
Another caller here, someone from the campus, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for the program. I missed a bit of it, so I hope these things haven't been covered. My first question is, when I first heard of clipping BT into plants, I thought it was being done in potatoes. Are we all eating BT potatoes right now and we just don't know it?
There are BT potatoes, but to my knowledge, they're not on the market yet in the United States. Well, it's possible. I did hear a rumor that they might be in chipping potatoes, but I can't answer that for 100% for sure.
Okay. My next question, I'll make it quick. Organic farmers use BT quite judiciously because insects become resistant to it. It seems to me like if it's in every cell of every plant that's being grown in a whole field, it would very quickly lose any possible efficacy.
You're absolutely right. It's very clear that if you overuse BT, the insects become resistant to it very quickly. And no entomologists, people who study insects, seriously believe that, nor the companies themselves, seriously believe that the BT crops will work for more than about 2 to 5 years before the insects overcome it. Now, when a representative from Monsanto spoke at a national conference of entomologists here in the United States in Las Vegas that I attended a few years ago, basically all of the entomologists agreed this will only work for a few years if it works at all. And the Monsanto person's response was very honest. He said, I work in industry where we have something called the product cycle, and it's the same whether it's the automobile industry, the television industry, the seed industry, the pesticide industry. You expect a new product to have a product life of a few years before you develop another product, and your whole marketing strategy and your pricing strategy is designed to recover your investment and make your profit in a few years. Meanwhile, you're developing the next generation of products. So, hey, you tell me this product will only work for 2 to 5 years. I tell you, hey, that's a normal product cycle. What's the problem? Problem is, of course, organic farmers and many other farmers rely on the natural form of BT as a natural pesticide, and if all the insects become resistant to it because of overuse in BT crops, then organic farmers will lose one of the most important tools that they have.
Exactly. Third, quickly, if these things aren't safe for people to eat directly, or there's a question about it, what makes anybody think it's safe to feed it to the animals that we then eat?
Well, good question. I mean, I don't have the answer, but I share your doubts.
Okay, thanks.
Right, thank you for the call. We have someone next here in Munster, Indiana. It's line 4. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just wondering what effect you think that the appointment of Ann Veneman as Secretary of Agriculture will have on the pushing forward of GM foods.
Well, I don't know her specific position on GM foods, but I do know that she is well known for being a very close friend of industry in general. And so I would say that it bodes very ill in terms of those of us who have concerns about the safety of these products. I suspect her to use her office to promote the interests of the private sector rather than the public interest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There has been some discussion in this country about labeling. That is putting if a food is genetically modified, if a product has some GM content, some people think there should be a label on there that says that. Do you think that it's possible that any time in the near future that here in this country we would have a labeling requirement like that?
I think it's quite possible. The two things that people are fighting for are, one, labeling based on the principle that the consumer has the right to know and the right to choose. And the other thing is a moratorium on commercial use until safety testing can be conducted. I really think we need to push for both. If we only get labeling and don't do the safety testing, then we'll be running tremendous risk because we won't be able to buy just the GE-labeled free food and it'll still be out there in the environment. On the other hand, we do have the right to know. So our position is that we need to have both. We need to have a commercial moratorium and we need to have labeling. And I think that it's possible that as the pressure from the public rises, that industry and the government will be willing at some point to concede labeling, but we'll have to fight a lot harder, but we need to get the moratorium.
Another caller here. Next, it's Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello. There's another problem that isn't exactly related to what you're discussing, but the BT and the other genetically modified crops are patented, and therefore, where a gene comes into the gene pool and it's bred into a number of different lines in normal production, it seems to me that this would tend to concentrate the or restrict the diversity of the gene pool within a crop, that because only one producer would control all of the seed output, there would be very restricted number of varieties on the market. Is this a danger?
This is a very large danger. This is one. This is another one of the very large and sort of hidden dangers. But because, unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 decision that life could be patented, they basically opened the door for big-time money to go into the seed industry and to start patenting genes one after another, and for the little seed companies to get swallowed up by the big seed companies, and then the big seed companies to get swallowed up by the pesticide companies who are now trying to market their pesticides through the seeds. Their whole goal is, by patenting this genetic material, to charge a lot higher price and therefore get a much larger profit at the expense of farmers' production costs. At the same time, as you point out, there are fewer and fewer companies, and they're trying to get more and more market domination and market share for one or two or three seed varieties where maybe there were several hundred before. And so it's very rapidly reducing the genetic diversity of crops that's planted in the field, and that poses enormous risks. I mean, the potato famine happened in Ireland because Ireland was basically planting only one variety of potatoes with regard to resistance to this particular potato disease, and so when the disease came, it wiped out the whole thing. The less genetic diversity we have in our crops, the more susceptible they will be when a new disease variant comes along and with the potential to wipe all of them out. And so this is a tremendous risk, not to mention the fact that they're basically using patents to get windfall profits by extorting farmers much higher prices for the seeds that they use. That's certainly not good news to the American farmer, who's already being squeezed into bankruptcy pretty much across the board.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Precisely.
All right. Well, thanks for
the
call. About 10 minutes left. Again, other questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Again, our guest is Peter Rossett. He's co-director of Food First. Questions certainly are welcome. Farmers certainly are in a bind, and I think sometimes they become impatient with environmentalists, particularly around this issue, because they say, on the one hand, environmentalists don't like farmers spraying a lot of chemicals. So then along comes, say, for example, a product like BT corn, which produces its own insecticide, and that means that the farmer will then, to get rid of the bugs, won't have to go out and spray, which would seem, on the face of it, as far as environmentalists were concerned, a good thing, because he's spraying less insecticide. But now the environmentalists are saying, we don't like this crop for a variety of reasons that we've cited, and farmers seem to feel like they're in trouble no matter what they do.
Well, I think it's unfortunate that the way the issue is presented both to farmers and to the general public is that there are only two choices. The one choice is to use pesticide, and the other choice is to use genetically engineered crops. And that's misleading on a couple of levels. On one level, the fact that they're mutually exclusive. In fact, more than 80% of the genetically engineered crops planted contain herbicide tolerance genes and are actually designed to get farmers to use more pesticide, not less. So by and large, the pesticides and the GE crops go hand in hand, and of course they're made by the same companies. The only exception would be in the case of the BT crops, which are less than 20% of the ones out there, where in theory the BT crop would replace pesticides. However, A, we've got all these safety questions about it. B, in the best of cases, it will only work for 2 to 3 or maybe 5 years before they fail and the folks may be back to the pesticides again. But most importantly, it's not just two choices. There are quite a lot of other choices. And in fact, before the GE crop mania came along, we were quite a ways towards reducing pesticide use and demonstrating that integrated pest management and biological pest control and even organic farming all offered very viable ways to dramatically reduce pesticide use, 50% in some cases, 100% in others. And it seemed like we'd found the path and we were beginning to follow it. And all of a sudden we got distracted by this red herring of genetic engineering. In fact, what we need to do is to continue down that path and get to safe farming practices that don't rely on either pesticides or genetically engineered crops, and that's absolutely feasible and viable, and that's the direction we should be heading down.
Mm. There also has been some question people raised about the plants that are bred genetically engineered to be herbicide tolerant, like Roundup Ready soybeans, for example. The idea there is that you can spray the herbicide to get rid of your weeds, and if you get some of it on soybeans, it's no big deal because the soybeans don't care. There has been some questions raised about whether, in fact, that has led to greater herbicide use rather than less. Is there any information available to settle that question one way or another?
Well, it does lead to greater herbicide use, and the whole point of it is to lead to greater herbicide use. The reason why companies that manufacture herbicides want to create herbicide-resistant crops is so that people can and will use more herbicides on them. That's the whole point. There's no other reason why a company who manufactures herbicides like Monsanto in the case of Roundup would pursue that particular line of research. And so that is the goal and that is the outcome. There's really, you know, that's what it was designed to do. That's what it does, and it shouldn't surprise anybody. And that's, as I said, is more than 80% of the crops that are planted out there are the herbicide-tolerant ones. And so, in fact, overall, on the average, genetic engineering will lead to greater pesticide use, not less pesticide use, and because that's essentially the goal that the companies have in developing these particular technologies.
We have several callers, about 5 minutes. We'll get as many as we can, starting with Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Thank you for a wonderful program. I just heard a program from Pacifica Radio relating to our sylvan future that spoke to the hormonal havoc and endocrine disruptors that is occurring as a result of the chemicals that are unleashed into the environment worldwide and producing ramifications in regions far from the points of origin. And your program is amplifying the scope of everything, focusing on genetic modified food, but the chemical disruption that's occurring is illustrated by the speaker who wrote the book Our Stolen Future, to the point where animals in this country, say the otter in the Columbia River, now are having their sexual identity so altered that if a census was taken among them and they were to check off the box, are you male or female, they would say none of the above. And other ramifications are occurring where the chemical messengers are disrupting the regular messages that are occurring in the body's communication network, to the point where it's really getting so scrambled, it's a horrific scenario for the future.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. It's an excellent book, Our Stolen Future. It talks about how certain pesticides and some other chemicals released into our environment can have these kinds of effects, perhaps even implications in the worldwide decline in sperm count amongst human beings. And I think it's a cautionary tale that we would do well to heed when we think about genetic engineering. In the case of pesticides, we were assured that they were safe by the same companies that are now assuring us that the genetically engineered crops are safe. At the time, the same kinds of people and organizations who doubted their claims of safety about pesticides were dismissed as being environmental kooks, much as people are dismissed today as for being kooks if they're concerned about genetic engineering. But as the truth emerges, and now it's only 30, 40, 50 years after the introduction of pesticides that we're finding out that the environmentalists were right all along, that pesticide use may be tied in with the epidemic of breast cancer around the world, with declining sperm count, with premature pubescence amongst teenagers, with a whole variety of different things, with confused sexual identity amongst animals. This is all stuff that was only suspected before, and it took 30 or 40 years because the research wasn't being done. I say let's learn the lesson, and let's say with this new generation of technology, let's not repeat the errors of the past. Let's stop, take a time out, and say let's do the research before rather than finding out after the damage is already done.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line 1. Hello.
Hi, I tuned in late, so you may have already touched on this, but related to the sort of themes of more pesticide use and companies with very, very deep pockets engineering seeds to be used with their brand of pesticides, and then even more not allowing the farmers to keep back portions of their seeds for the next year. It seems that, with this administration, I fear it's going to get worse. So the whole trend toward that was sort of taken off toward organic farming, which is fairly strong in California, and we were starting to see some of that here, I think, is at real risk from these companies who aren't really interested in doing that, because it's not in their fiscal interest to promote organic farming, because they won't sell their seeds or their pesticides. And also the sort of marketization, for lack of a better word, of trends in food like fat-free and now organic may lead to a sort of dilution of the strict standards that California, the sort of California organic movement has adhered to, which most organic producers adhere to today. I was wondering if you could say whether you think this administration will dilute that and cause us even...
Well, luckily, the outgoing administration managed to get pretty acceptable national organic standards set up. So hopefully the new administration won't roll that back. I mean, I can't guarantee that, but hopefully. And that will give some protection to organic. Personally, I think organic is going to continue to grow quite quickly, despite the fact that it's not in the interest of a lot of agribusiness companies who are dominating agriculture and promoting genetically engineered crops, precisely because the public is concerned, and the public increasingly would like to eat safer food, and the public increasingly correctly perceives organic food as being safer. So I suspect that the two trends are going to continue, and we're going to be moving for a while now into a sort of bimodal food system, where we'll have the corporate poisoned food system on one hand growing very quickly, and on the other hand the safe food, small farmer, local production, and even urban agriculture food system growing very quickly as well. And I'm hoping that concerned consumers will exert their power in the marketplace to gradually swing things towards the safer, healthier, more environmentally and socially sound food system that's going to be developing alongside this corporate poison food system.
We are going to have to stop there with our thanks to our guest, Peter Rossett. He's co-director of Food First. And again, if you're interested in exploring what their organization is about, and you can get onto the web, you can look for them at www.foodfirst.org. They have information on this and other issues. Dr. Rossett, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.